Morning, everybody. We would typically at this point in our morning stop for a land acknowledgement. And as with last week's talky bit, the terrain we're in feels so much like it's about the same sorts of things that a land acknowledgement touches on that I want to go on a little bit of a divergence here. I don't know if you've ever had the experience at the table that I'm about to talk about, but I have, and I suspect others have too. And it's referencing a time at the table, you know, where we used to gather physically. You remember that? Can you, anyone? So we're in the room together, and somebody at the front says something to the group that begins with the phrase, "We believe," or "Here at the table, we believe," or something like that. And then they go on to make a statement that doesn't match what you believe at all. How does that feel? Well, on a good day, if I showed up feeling pretty solid, pretty grounded, pretty sort of clear about where I am in my own process of exploring belief, maybe that feels interesting. Maybe that feels worth exploring. It feels more like a different perspective. But on a day that is not so much like that, on a day where things are feeling a little fragile, it can feel like a reason to run for the door. It can feel like a moment in which something inside of you or inside of me says, "Oh, I guess I'm not part of this we after all." So if we find ourselves in a moment like that, now what? Do I leave? Do I give up what I find in that situation that is good, in that community that is good? Do I try to influence the shape of that we? Do I try to maybe add to or make bigger the understanding of what this particular we believes or embraces? Or do I start a new we where I get to say what we believe? It's complicated. Now, we are all part of things where we don't dictate the shape of the belief, of the thing itself, and we're all part of things for which we as individuals use we as collective language. So, for instance, we might identify as Canadian, a national we. But inside of that experience, there are distinctives, there are even divisions. There are, for obvious instance, different political parties. And then there is also the physical land that might be commonly identified as Canada. But there are people that live and move and have their being every day on this chunk of the planet for whom that national entity, the Dominion of Canada, is not the one in which they hold their national identity. They might not find that border. I mean, can you see it in the dirt? They might not find that border between Canada and the US, for example, especially meaningful. Some of them would identify as Indigenous or First Nations peoples, depending on context, or maybe identify with the name of their people or their tribe. Some of them would understand that they were already a we long before the Europeans got here and started this convoluted and sometimes quite violent process that eventually ended up assigning the name Canada to this sort of relatively arbitrarily outlined part of the planet. So when someone says we, it's kind of like that fish illustration from last week, about which I've had some further correspondence with people, by the way. It doesn't mean the same thing to everyone. When I say, for instance, we gather on Treaty One land, personally, I am not giving lip service to a politically correct sentiment. I'm making a limited engagement with a complex piece of history as well as a complex piece of the present and the future. And that is one of the reasons why I personally try to remember to say that I am grateful that we are welcome on this land. You might not feel that way at all. I hope you do. I may even be so bold as to say, I believe you should. But it is not my place to tell you that you must. So, I am grateful that we are made welcome on this land, which in this particular part of this continent is Treaty One land and the homeland of the Métis Nation. We are not at the talkie bit yet. Anybody need to stop and catch their breath? Oh, my word. I do. So, if you choose to participate in this, we're going to stop and breathe together. Let's try, if you're participating in this part of our morning, let's try a little different rhythm this morning. So we're going to breathe in through our nose. We're going to cradle our breath. We're going to forcefully exhale through our mouths. And the rhythm we're going to use, again, not a new one, although it's maybe new in this context, is we're going to breathe in through our nose for a count of four. We're going to cradle our breath for a count of seven. Then we're going to exhale forcefully through our mouths for a count of eight. All right, and let's do four rounds of that, just so we remember four, seven, eight, maybe a little more easily. All right, and Lenny, if you're watching, Lenny thinks this part's really funny. Lenny, if you're watching, I'm not asleep when I close my eyes, but if you want to cheer when I wake up, you can. All right, here we go. Let's breathe together. Peace, everybody. Alrighty then, let's get this underway. Last week, we started a bit of an exploration around the idea of decolonizing religion. Decolonizing is maybe a relatively new idea to some, and one we'll be exploring for just a little bit yet. But in that particular talkie bit, we brushed briefly up against something called the doctrine of discovery. And then I sort of backed away just because of time, and I said we would explore that a bit more this week. So here we go. Now, we're not going to get all the way there. What a ridiculous idea. But I think we'll make some meaningful progress, and then we're going to go a little further with some of the things that are connected to this next week. And who knows? We'll see how far we get next week. Anyway, that much I can tell you. Now, just a moment before we kind of get into the details to connect this to the reason that the table exists as a community, which is to make room to explore what we believe. In many ways, you could characterize what we're exploring today as a piece of the history of Christianity, which might logically raise the question, who cares? So we might say, well, Christians should care because it's part of their history. But here at the table, not everyone would identify as Christian. In fact, some of us would be quite emphatic and quite clear about not identifying that way. But here's an important overlap. As we're going to see along the way, the wider culture that we're in here in this continent at this time has been deeply impacted by, I'm going to say, so-called Christian ideas and values. And not a little bit impacted, and often not to the good. And that's important. So I feel pretty confident in saying that most of the people in this community are deeply committed to making a positive contribution to the world that we're in. Here's the thing. If we can't trace the past into the present, if we don't know our own history, then we're not going to know how to explain or engage with current conditions in ways that are transformative. What's most likely going to happen instead, as the natural alternative to transformative engagement, is we are going to engage in something that is either obviously or sort of benignly victim blaming. And that is not helpful. So no matter how you identify spiritually, I think this is a relevant exploration. And attitudinally, as always at the table, at least from my perspective, you decide what's a relevant exploration. I don't decide. I mean, I know I'm the one talking, but you're the one with the off button. You decide. Today, in particular, we'll be largely focused on some examination of the foundations of this thing that is called the doctrine of discovery, or the discovery doctrine. Now, as with many ideas, kind of big 30,000 foot sort of ideas especially, opinions about this one are anything but uniform. At the one extreme, you would be solidly in the terrain of alternative facts if you were to try to deny the historicity of something called the doctrine of discovery. This is a real thing. It is written down, it is well documented, it is much observed and studied and commented on. There's an enormous body of work that one could reference around this, and rapidly growing body of work, I should add. Of course, not everybody understands the meanings and implications of the doctrine of discovery the same way. Now, that's not new. As with so many things for which we might use a word like doctrines, different groups, never mind different individuals, are going to have very differing takes on it. This intrigues me because that there are differences of opinion is this is just not a surprise. This is not unusual about almost anything. As I said, never mind something that's sort of like a big idea. But when we be more specific about a big idea and we call it a doctrine, that moves us into some other understandings of what it is we're talking about. And what I find intriguing in this case is that differing opinions or perspectives is built right into the idea of what constitutes something we would call a doctrine. Here's what I mean by that. The word itself in the English language, and I mean, as an aside, language is a tool, right? We can use a hammer to smash somebody's precious toy, or we can use a hammer to build somebody a shelter. It's a tool. What we do with it is rather significant. Language is a tool. We can use it to oppress. English has been used that way. We can use it to divide. English has been used that way. We can use it to tell someone we love them and to express something deep and meaningful and make a connection and express care. Language can do that, right? This is important because when I reference definitions, I'm in that terrain of using language in a certain way, and a particular language and its history. So doctrine, the English word doctrine, comes from, as so many English language words do, from the Latin word doctrina. And that word means teaching or instruction. So a doctrine, in our kind of contemporary use of the word, is a codification of beliefs or a body of teachings and instructions, taught principles or positions that represent the essence of teachings in a given branch of knowledge or a belief system. Some of you in this community I know grew up Catholic. You might be interested to know that the Greek sort of etymological or history of language equivalent to the Latin word doctrine is the Greek word catechism, which of course is a time in a young Catholic's life where they learn the doctrines of that denomination of Christianity. So that kind of fits together, right? If we didn't point it out, most of us probably wouldn't even notice that every aspect of those definitions was built on Greco-Roman or European understandings and language. And I'm not going to say anything further about that observation. I think most of the implications are going to become fairly obvious as we go. The important part for our purposes at this moment, in this exploration, is this phrase in that definition which says, in a given branch of knowledge or in a belief system. In other words, doctrines, by that definition, mean something different from within the defining group than they do from outside the defining group. In fact, they might not be meaningful or even especially comprehensible at all from outside of it. And frankly, sometimes from within side of it. Ever heard anybody try to explain the Trinity? Woo! Anyway, that's a doctrine. Now, I want to read a snippet from a novel. Actually, it's from a pair of novels written by a relatively new novelist, but a well-known science educator, a guy named Hank Green. Any of you have ever watched any of the Crash courses, for example, that's Hank Green. Just recently wrote and published a pair of novels called An Absolutely Remarkable Thing and A Beautifully Foolish Endeavor. Now, I don't want to leak any spoilers. I'm trying to sum up these books. That's challenging, but I want to do that without giving the plot away, but I want us to have at least a little bit of context. So when I was trying to think of how to do this, I just thought, well, how'd they do it on Hank's website? Because he wouldn't want to give away the spoilers. So this is how somebody wrote a blurb about the first of those two novels, and I think that'll give us enough context for the piece I want to read. So here's the blurb. Roaming through New York City at 3 a.m., 23-year-old April May stumbles across a giant sculpture. Delighted by its appearance and craftsmanship, like a 10-foot-tall transformer wearing a suit of samurai armor, April and her best friend Andy make a video with it, which Andy uploads to YouTube. The next day, April wakes up to a viral video and a new life. News quickly spreads that there are Carls in dozens of cities around the world, from Beijing to Buenos Aires, and April, as their first documentarian, finds herself at the center of an intense international media spotlight, which it's fair to say upends her entire world. So that's the first novel. Now, in the second novel, due to various events and circumstances, Andy, who was the videographer of that initial offering, Andy finds himself sort of taking April's place at the center of that media storm. It turns out that these sculptures, the Carls, actually function a lot the way many of our more familiar concepts of God function, including the fact that they seem to have all knowledge, they can see future events, and yet they give humans some agency and so on. There's this really kind of fascinating interplay, and that interplay and that experience has got people all around the world deep in existential crisis. And that's all I'm going to say, because going any further is bound to spoil some key plot points for anyone that decides to read the books for themselves. So when we pick up this little bit that I want to read here is early in the second novel. And the way the novels are written, there's a bunch of different first-person voices. We hear from the different characters as in their voice. And so at this point in the story, we are hearing from Andy in his voice. So this is Andy speaking. God was different post-Carl. And that was a big deal for a lot of people. But God had never been a big part of my life, even when I was a little kid. I was raised in a secular household by a man and a woman who were both raised in secular households. There aren't a lot of third-generation atheists in the world. For a guy who was born an atheist, I had a lot of books by religious folks on my nightstand. I hated the whole religion is the root of all evil perspective that a lot of atheists, and to be honest, myself, not that long ago, professed. For me, it goes without saying that much of the dogma of religion is harmful. Thinking that other people will burn forever because they love the wrong person or worship the wrong God has done a whole lot of bad. What I wanted was the part where people were asked to get together once a week to talk about how to be a good person and, like, hang out with their neighbors. It's pretty amazing that apparently the only way to get people to do that is to invent an all-seeing, kind-hearted sky dad who will be super disappointed / burn you for eternity if you don't show up. And then Andy goes on to talk about how it would probably take just such a threat to get him out of bed on a Sunday morning, but also how it seems like a lot of people are looking to him at this moment in history for advice on those same sorts of ways that they might look to religious or community leaders. And so he's been trying to learn from those religious and community leaders, even if he doesn't share the beliefs that many of them espouse. Feels like he owes it to his community, his fans, and so on, to be thoughtful about this stuff. Now, in the context of this talky bit, dogma, as Andy talks about it in that quote, is exchangeable with doctrine, as we've been talking about it this morning. In the Western world, dogma is generally taken to mean the doctrine or belief in a religion or political system. So you can see that right away when we're defining dogma, we're doing it using the ideas about doctrine. In the Western world, dogma is generally taken to mean that, this doctrine or belief in a religion or political system, but the literal meaning of dogma in ancient Greek was, and I love this, something that seems true. Now, these days, in English, if you think about it for a moment, we're not using dogma that way. Dogma has become much more absolute. If you say you believe in a certain religion or philosophy, you will be taken to, it'll sort of, people will take you as someone who must then believe in its dogma or its core assumptions. Now, from where I sit, it sounds like we might be better off with the Greek understanding, that older definition of something that seems true. It's got a bit more room for holding a belief loosely rather than, as we might say these days, holding it dogmatically. So for someone like Andy, a doctrine that says you have to adhere to certain codified religious beliefs, including particular understandings of God, seems like the sort of nonsense that can do a great deal of harm. But getting together with other people, even in the name of religion, to work with our neighbors at making a better world, that Andy would be down for. If Andy ever showed up to anything that kind of looked like church, his showing up might look just like the rest of the group's showing up, but the beliefs that motivated him to do so would be quite different. And this is important to our exploration of something like the doctrine of discovery, because although the doctrine itself is important, so are the ways in which it was typically held and enacted. It's sort of like this two-part invention, right? What we believe matters a lot. How we hold what we believe matters a lot. And those two things together tend to be sort of the engine that drives how we live out what we believe. What we believe and how we hold that belief. Those two things in combination tend to be what informs our actions. So when we come to something like the doctrine of discovery, we come to an interesting aspect of this, because some doctrines, some core or summing beliefs, by their very content, dictate ways of holding that belief that makes it very difficult to hold it and not do harm. The actual content of the thing, the what we believe, says something so insistent about how we must hold it that it's very hard to have the what and the how and not be doing harm. We're going to see how that pertains to this particular doctrine shortly, but just onto the doctrine itself for a moment. And I should say at this point that I'm struggling a bit to know whether I should say was or is when I talk about the doctrine of discovery, because although the idea that I'm about to describe is increasingly coming under open critique, it has been roundly condemned by various bodies within the UN, it is slowly, astonishingly slowly, being publicly disavowed by various Christian denominations. Despite all of that, it is still very much a factor in the laws of the government of the Dominion of Canada. So, as with many things that really need to change, this is a slow, multi-layered process, and it is, I'm afraid, not over yet. So, because of the continuing influence of these ideas in the here and now, I'm going to say is when I talk about this doctrine, which might strike us as a little strange. That's okay. If it feels kind of dissonant and arbitrary, if it feels totally arbitrary, then we probably just haven't thought very much yet about the ways in which this doctrine is still very much active in our cultural reality. Anyway, here we go. So the doctrine of discovery is a philosophical framework for, and air quotes here if you're on the podcast, for Christian explorers to lay claim to territories uninhabited by Christians, or to say it from the other perspective, to lay claim to lands already inhabited by peoples not claiming to be Christians. So that's sort of the very broad strokes of what the doctrine of discovery is. And it started to be articulated in like the 1100s or so, and it really got a full head of steam in the so-called Age of Discovery, 1400s and following. Now, under this belief, under this doctrine, title to lands lay with the government whose subjects traveled to and occupied a territory whose inhabitants were not subjects of a European Christian monarch. Title to lands lay with the government whose subjects traveled to and occupied a territory whose inhabitants were not subjects of a European Christian monarch. That's the short version of the doctrine of discovery in terms of its legal implications about land. Now, it's important to understand when we work with a phrase like that, that phrase subjects of a European Christian monarch, in the understanding of the time when this doctrine was generated, that equaled Christian. That's what it meant to be a Christian, was to be subject of a Christian monarch, a monarch who espoused Christian beliefs, right? So this whole idea of, you know, Christian equals personal relationship with Jesus and all that stuff, that all came, you know, quite a bit later. Land occupied by people in any other category of belief. Track this. Land occupied by people who believed anything other than that was regarded as no man's land. There's a nifty little Latin phrase for that too. It's sort of like blank land. People that didn't fit this category of belief, so they were not subjects of a European Christian monarch, people who didn't fit that category of belief were regarded, I mean, you can imagine, if their land was no man's land, what were they? They were regarded as roughly equivalent to the flora and fauna of that land. They had value, but the same sort of value that, like, timber or minerals might have. Right? If the land was occupied by, and again, the languages of the time, but if in terms of gendering, but if the land was occupied by no man, it was no man's land, but clearly there were humans there, what were those humans? I think it's easy to see how this can translate into the buying and selling of humans, right? We wouldn't tend to have moral reservations about selling our grain crop. And if people that don't believe what we believe don't have the same value that we do, then it's just a matter of where they are on the sliding scale of value. You get them far enough down the scale, and the moral dilemma of seeing them as product rather than people becomes a non-issue. Does that make sense? Because flora and fauna, not human. This is no human's land, but there's humans here. Wait. See? So this is verticality of this idea that allowed this, all of this stuff to happen. Didn't just allow this stuff to happen. Didn't just permission it to happen. It connected it to this understanding that the people making it happen, the European explorers, were not just given the right to do it by God, but they were given the mission to do it by God. If that strikes you as incredibly twisted, then hold that thought. This is a doctrine that was strongly held, for example, by King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain, the royal couple that financed Columbus's first expedition to America. And we might sort of think, oh, the 1400s, that was long ago, that was far away, that is not relevant. That is not the case. The physical room where those two monarchs met with Columbus to vest him with this idea of authority and send him off is still a very intact room. It is in good repair. It is open to the public. I know all this because I've stood in it. And it reeks of wealth and power to this day. The Spanish monarchs were strongly backed on this by Pope Alexander VI, who confirmed their right of possession of all newly discovered lands in the Americas. And in so doing, he was repeating what had been said earlier by other popes such as Nicholas V. Now, it's interesting. If you start to really dig into this, you start to read some of the academic work on it, one of the things you'll fairly quickly come across is the historic information that there were some folks in the same time period who thought otherwise. That not everybody was buying the doctrine of discovery ideas. But the people who thought otherwise didn't win. In the end, the force of what happened followed the doctrine of discovery, and the harm was done. Also, I know I just used past tense, those ideas and assumptions are still very much alive and present in our contemporary legal systems. And if you think that's sort of a soft opinion, just do a couple minute search on anything that has to do with dismantling the doctrine of discovery and Canada's legal system, and you're going to find plenty of actual cases written up of contemporary legal rulings in this country that have the doctrine of discovery as their legal basis. Yeah. So, this is where we live. Now, this period of history, that 1100s, 1400s, right in there, this is also the time frame where, in European thought, the idea of religion was constructed. Mark. Now, we, that is humans, and in particular white male European humans, came up with that entire construct, which is kind of interesting. And we did so, not surprisingly, under the banner of Christianity, which in our contemporary world means, among other things, that the study of world religions, which is an academic discipline, is largely a discipline that compares everything else to Christianity and regards Christianity as the only sort of valid benchmark for the category of religion. That's what everything's measured against. And that's why you might have heard me say on some occasions that some don't consider Buddhism a religion because it has no deity, like Christianity does. So maybe if the concept of religion as a category had traveled from the cultures that nurtured Buddhism into the cultures of Europe instead of the other way around, we would be saying Christianity isn't really a religion because it has a deity, and real religions don't have those. See what I'm after here? But that is not how the story has gone. Religion as a category of comparative study was invented by European Christians who, without questioning it, made the assumption that they had the right to do so and to dictate this as doctrine, as a core assumption for the rest of humanity. So you can see how these things kind of interlock in terms of our shared history on these lands. Just a little exercise of the imagination. Whatever the first peoples of these lands already believed when the European explorers got here, including what those first peoples believed about land and about the kinds of mysteries for which the European settlers used God language, including all of those things were categorically invalidated by those explorers because they arrived with these ideas about what constituted religion, who had the right to own land, and where the power behind all of those understandings was grounded. All of those things could be fairly characterized as vertical. They are structures that start with the idea that the doctrine or dogma, the defined belief, core belief, that belief is superior. I've spent way too much of my life, would be my opinion at this point, in educational settings that taught me how to pick apart other systems of belief relative to the Christian system of belief, and to demonstrate how those other systems were inferior. That's a legacy of this realm of thinking, that there's this one particular set of doctrines that is superior to all the others. And guess what? The people that hold that set of doctrines are also, in their own understanding, superior to all the other people because they believe what is right. They believe the superior idea. That's the logic. I'm not defending it. I'm just articulating it. So you can see how this plays out, right? This is, you've heard me be critical in this setting, if you've been around the table for a while, of strategies of evangelism that include things like, you know, become friends with the rationale, you know, so that you can share what you believe. We might kind of feel like that's fairly benign, right? Like, that's, isn't that nice? You get to know your neighbor, you tell them what you believe. But if you follow through a lot of those strategies, you find out that, I mean, the goal is conversion. It's them coming to what you believe. Why? Because what you believe is superior. Why else would we want someone to believe it in a way that meant we were strategic about shifting their belief so that it matched ours? So you can sort of see how this plays out, right? But it's so woven in to the fabric of religion, as Christianity understands religion, that most of us, if we grew up around it, we don't even notice it. We just work with it. Benevolent oppression is still oppression. And we need to name it. Otherwise, we get caught in that thing that I was talking about earlier, where if we don't know our own history, we're not likely to engage in the present in transformative ways. We're more likely to blame the victims. Now, that is the kind of perspective that we have. We have right doctrine, right dogma, and it says that because we have right belief, when we come to lands where there are other beliefs, we can claim them as ours. And when we come to people without these same beliefs, we can regard them as not fully people, lesser people, people with value, but value like trees and minerals and crops have value. And that's all okay because they don't believe what we believe. Now, if they come over to what we believe, then their status changes. They become what? Fully human? Anyway, the status changes, right? We can talk about where they came from, that horrible thing they came from before they came to this good thing, that kind of idea. That perspective has produced what we would now call colonization. And that's where we're going to stop today, because now we need to define some terms. We need to get into talking about what we understand a word like colonization to mean in our contemporary context, what it has looked like historically, and then we can talk about what it means to decolonize something, whether that's our own thinking, our own approach to language, our own approach to belief, to religion, to comparing religions, if that's something we do, and so on. That colonizing ideas have infiltrated pretty much everything that functions in our culture at this point. And so once we start watching for it, we'll see how pervasive it is. But once we see how pervasive it is, we can also connect the present to the past, and then we can ask ourselves questions about what does it look like to decolonize our own thinking, our own ways of speaking, our own ways of doing business, our own ways of relating, our own ways of being spiritual persons, and believing things. And I think that's an important conversation. All right, listen, thanks for hanging in there. That's pretty heady, right? That's pretty much head first, some of that stuff. And I understand that. If I could think of a way to end run it, I would, on behalf of the people who find it difficult to wade through that stuff. On the other hand, I don't feel especially apologetic about covering some of that ground, because these are the kind of things that in many instances we have been silent about for too long, that we have glanced away from rather than look at. And they're the sorts of exact things that we need to look at and take apart and consider and wrestle with if we're going to explore not only what we believe as individuals, but what we believe as collectives, and how we enact those beliefs, how we hold what we believe, and to ask ourselves really directly and deeply, are there ways to hold the things that we espouse as beliefs and have them do good and not harm? All right. Peace, everybody. Thanks for listening. And I look forward to being with you next week this way. Bye for now.